What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either. Really.
Go.
Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here.
Hi, friends.
Happy Monday.
Here we are. Oh my gosh, we have Laura Danger with us here on the pod this morning. And just a quick little intro, if you don't already know Laura Danger, while I'm talking, go to Instagram and follow That Darn Chat. That is how I found Laura and like couldn't look away, like did a very real binge of the videos that I found there, and then quickly found her podcast, Time to Lean, and did my own little podcast binge. And besides the fact that Laura is really just a fun person to listen to, besides the fact that her voice is gorgeous, and I don't mind listening to that all afternoon, she's ridiculously smart and very, I would say, satisfyingly incisive in the things that she talks about. I was really captivated specifically by the way that she seems to sort of have her thumb directly on these default narratives that we have, like deeply embedded in our culture. So specifically, a lot of it looking at like domestic labor and care work in our society and this sort of deeply ingrained myth that we have that care work and domestic work is not as valuable as power and wealth and sort of the ways that that can be wrapped up in gender norms and expectations and how that spills over into our families and relationships. And I'm also really interested in the way that you talk about expectation and the paths that we are expected to follow and how to sort of disrupt that. So we have a lot to talk about today. But I like the way that you are able to name some of these really embedded narratives that we have built into us almost like from birth that feel really weighty and heavy, but also really hard to talk about. It's almost like an invisible dynamic sometimes that can be hard to name that play out in really meaningful parts of our life. So we have a lot to talk with you about today. But first of all, just wanted to thank you so much for being here and taking the time to chat with us.
I'm so excited to be here. I could talk about this nonstop all the time, all day, every day.
Perfect. Yay. This is all we want. Okay. We like to start our interviews by asking about little Laura. So how would you describe your young self and what scripts were you absorbing about the world or your place in it?
Great question. And we can dive right into my experience with, so I was diagnosed with ADHD and bipolar 2 at 33. So let's say little Laura was a pleasure to have in class. However, not reaching her potential. And I stuck out. I was an oddball, but always trying to fit in. I don't know. I got all of the same scripts that everyone else did, but I saw myself as like existing outside of them. I was like the artsy one. I was a feminist. I was like the punk emo kid. So I think I saw myself as the exception. However, I watched all the same like teen movies and had a crush on Freddie Prinze Jr. and like all that stuff. I think that was me.
And okay, so that's interesting to hear that you already saw yourself outside of those scripts from a really young age. It makes me really curious about how they actually, like the power that they ended up having on you, even if you saw yourself outside of them. So I guess I'm wondering, Maybe could you talk with us a little bit more about how it became so important to you to name this script and like call it out, and if there was any sort of arc or journey in that process for you of that becoming so important to name?
Absolutely. So I am, I guess this is important context. I'm in a part of a cishet couple, and I've been with my husband for like 16 years. We have two kids, third grade and kindergarten.
Wow.
So I want to say, like I said, I thought I was choosing this life. I thought that all of this was like up to me. I want the romance, but I don't need the romance. Like, that's what I thought. I would like to be a mom, but I don't need to be a mom. And like me and my friends, my artsy emo friends would like have parties, and I saw them as different than like the trad wife stuff that we see. And our casseroles were like, we wanted to make those. We were on epicurious.com. We weren't like reading Betty Crocker. And I think I was like a little smug about it. And then I always wanted to have a career. I was a full-time teacher. I taught full-time, and my husband had a full-time job. And then I got pregnant at like, I don't know, 26. I haven't thought about that in a while. But 27, 28, whatever. It was like later than my friends from the suburb I grew up in, but like earlier than the friends in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It was cool at first having a baby. Like, that was fun. It was like aesthetic, you know, it was cute. We had like matching outfits. Everything was adorable. And I was like a new kind of mom. I was like a cool mom. And I just continued to see myself as different. And then the whole dual career thing, my husband working really, really long hours. He had like a really interesting, he was streaming on Twitch and like doing, again, like kind of outside the norm type of things, working a creative job. And he would travel a lot. And I was home a lot by myself, holding it down. And I was smart and capable and independent and maintaining relationships and a full-time teacher and really involved in activism and in my neighborhood. And I was also getting in big fights at home and being like, I can do this. I don't want to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned the lack of diagnosis, because that really impacted me, and I didn't realize that it was impacting me until much later. But, you know, I went through that. I had a second kid a couple of years later, and the shit hit the wall. Like, second kid, I got laid off on maternity leave with that one. And then over the course of like 6 months from the spring of 2019, I lose my job. Our health insurance is at risk. I get a new job. Chicago Teachers Union goes on strike for like a half a month. And then 2020 hits.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all stuck in our homes, and, you know, the rug gets pulled out from underneath us. And through that journey, like through all of that, my husband and I are falling into all these same traps that I'm seeing. Like, I see myself as different. And every time we're not different, I'm like embarrassed. I don't want people to know that we've done, like, that I'm like doing his laundry and cooking and cleaning and fighting about it. And so around 2019, 2020, in my personal life, we're going through like an upheaval. And then in 2020, I was seeing my friends going through it publicly. And, you know, we're seeing celebrities go through it, and people are leaving their careers. And I just started like shouting into TikTok, really, and then shouting into Instagram, and just like couldn't, I was met with, it was like a mirror, you know, people were there, they were experiencing it too. And I think maybe, I guess seeing someone like me, when I feel this way, seeing other people like me going, oh, I thought I signed up for this. I don't think I signed up for this. And I'm like embarrassed and this is not my values. Seeing that and connecting with other people has been so empowering.
Wow. That just like the piece of this, the tension between like, I'm not normal. We're outside of the norm. We're doing this differently. And then how is this exactly the cliche? Like, when did I turn into like a sitcom scene?
And I like just drew this whole diagram of you in this middle space where you like had kids when you were like so much older than like where you grew up. And so in those spaces, you're this like radical, modern feminist woman. And then, but in your actual, like where you're living and in your, like, what I wrote down was you were younger than all of your cool friends, which is how I sing this. And I'm forever in this middle space of like, in some spaces I'm like so radical. I'm so far out. I'm so wild. I'm like the diversity card. And then in other spaces, I'm like, I am this like fucking normie. And I just feel like, I don't want to talk about the fact that I have a husband or a kid. And it's like, then like, where do you belong? And the part, I'm just word vomiting. The part where you're like, it being embarrassed of all, and you're like, how did I become the person that I'm just like, okay, I am already crying inside. I don't cry outside because I have too many antidepressants in me. But I am just weeping internally because of Jesus fucking Christ.
Well, and it feels like you're naming in a lot of different ways, you're naming like just the actual weight, labor, difficulty, impossible uphill, pushing a boulder up a hill thing it is to try to actually do something new, like create a new dynamic, actually build that. It's one thing to want it and to think about it and to talk about it. And then when you're in it and there's so many other forces that are sort of shaping the experience. Wow. Yeah. Anyways, there's a lot to meaty, juicy stuff in there to.
I know. I feel like we could just stay on this and like ignore all our other questions. This feels like the question you're writing down just before this, Rebecca, of like, how do you know if you want it or not?
Yeah.
Or like, how do you know if this is an active choice that you have, or did you just fall into a default?
Yeah. I think it was even just this morning, or I watched it this morning, one of your videos, Laura, about like naming, you specifically named expectation. And like, if you don't want this, if you don't want kids, if you don't want a partnership, don't do it. Like we have been given these paths and we think we're supposed to want these things, but if you don't want them, you don't have to do them. Which, yes, is such an empowering thing to name and hand out and show people. But I am wondering about that in practice. And if you have any advice for how people can even know if they want some of these things, you know, like how do we know before we're in it? How do we decipher our longings versus the just like massive amount of content that we're fed that this is what you want or this is what a good life looks like? Like how do you think about that and the messiness of it?
I think that's really hard. And reflecting back on my own life, I try to be careful about the way I talk about things online because the perspective that I partnered with my partner when I was 20 and we've been together for most of my adult life. And we have children, and like I did follow so many of the scripts. I'm in a dual income still. Like I could leave if I wanted to, I'd be okay. And I have like a safety net and family and a degree. And like, I come from I have all of this privilege and I never really had to think through. I mean, I did a little bit around probably in my mid-20s when I was like, when my husband and I were like, are we going to get married or are we going to break up? You know, like that whole, like, we've been together for a long time. What are we doing here? And I thought to my, that was, I remember thinking like, I have a biological clock and I have, you know, friends, like I said, like I was one of the younger ones of my friends who did that. And I have friends still who are, you know, in their mid 30s thinking, what am I, do I want to have children? Will I have biological children by myself with someone else? So I have been sort of shielded from that. I haven't had to reflect so much on a personal level on that. But it's what I have appreciated in recent years compared to when I was thinking about getting married and having a kid was I see more truth online. And I do appreciate being a part of this movement to say like, oh yeah, the naggy wife, like that's not funny. Because you're going to see yourself as that in 3 years. Or like when you see that, it's not something to laugh at because it's so painful to be in the kitchen, especially like I really like my husband a lot as a person and would like to remain married to him, always have wanted to remain married to him. But there have been points when I'm like, the logistics of this are gonna like, I can't do this. I can't look at myself through this. I can't look at you through this. Oh my God, I'm so mad. Like, that's, we need to fix the logistics. And we can't normalize this, like, yelling at each other, this, like, cycle of, I call it the nag paradox of, like, tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to do. And I wish that I had seen that instead of the constant bombardment of sitcoms and couples comedy.
Well, I think like naming the difficulty of it is important, but I think like pointing the arrow out at looking at like how our culture participates in what we imagine for ourselves is an important part of it as well. But yeah, I don't know. Well, our second episode on this podcast was like, how do we decide if we want a second baby? And I think that the only thing we recorded was just like tornado swirls around it. It was just like, how do we make these decisions really? Like, and it's so unfair that like, I mean, partnership is one thing, but kids, like deciding whether or not to have kids is like this thing that you have so little information on before you do it. And it changes your life more than almost anything could. It just feels like a really unfair setup. I protest that. This shouldn't be that way. It's unfair.
I agree. And the thing is, I know you guys talk about this, but like not the lack of a support system or the presence of a support system, like the decision-making that I did at least was like, am I going to have a child myself? And one aspect that I thought through, especially with a second kid, was like, can I do this on my own if I need to do this on my own? Can us as a couple do this on our own, knowing what we know now? Do I have family? Do I have friends? What kind of childcare, long run financially? Like, if as a society, we kind of thought more collectively, that would probably make it a lot easier to decide.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. When we were thinking about our just to have a child or not, that was not factored in. And I don't know why I assumed. I just had this idea in my head that like, oh yeah, there'll be plenty of people to watch him. There'll be plenty of people to, right? Like, and then we got there and it was like, oh no. Like we should have had conversations with like 10 other people before we made this decision to figure out like, what are you, what is your availability and what, you know, like we just didn't think about that. So I love that you named that. That was a big part of our second decision too, of like, how much can we ask? How much are people available? How much money do we have to pay someone? Like,
all of those extra layers of care that people are like, us having a kid did not just impact us in a lot of real ways. We had a question about co-parenting, but you and your partner are still together, right?
We are. We are.
Okay.
People assume I'm either not partnered with a cis man.
Okay.
Or that I'm, yeah, separated or divorced or co-parenting. Yeah.
I spent a good portion of my marriage with everyone online thinking that I was not married. So that's an interesting thing that we could have a whole conversation about. But when I got married, the way I went into the wedding was like, here's all the ways that we'll get divorced. So if this doesn't work here, like, we're going to do this well, we're going to do it beautifully. We are not going to stay in something that harms each other. And as then we were thinking about kids, there were a few people online that I was following who had recently been divorced, and they were talking about what co-parenting was like for them. And I was like, holy shit, why are we not talking about parenting as co-parents? Like, I refer to my partner as my co-parent. We are co-creators, co-conspirators. And it's like when in a cishet relationship, if they're married, the presumed dominant is the mom as caregiver. She or they are, they know all the things. They're the capable one. They're the ones doing it. They carry all the responsibility. But the moment that there's a divorce, now they're equal, supposedly. They're co-parents, and then they both have equal responsibility on everything for like the days that they have the kids. And I was like, this is how we're going to do it too. Like, we are co-parenting. So my question that I wrote down was, what are the positives of co-parenting as a divorced couple that could apply to partnered parents? And I wrote that thinking that you were divorced, but I think this is a really important conversation for partnered parents to be having, because it just removes, assumptions. Like, when you get divorced, you have to like work out all of those logistics for the care of the kids. But when you're partnered, you just make a lot of assumptions about who's doing things.
And also, just to tag on to that, I think it's really interesting, speaking of assumptions, that we, and apparently so many people, assume that Laura is divorced. And like, what does that say about our, you know, like our assumptions about what co-parenting means and looks like? And so,
I also have learned a lot from, I've learned a lot from queer families, from like multi-generational households, and from divorced families. Yeah, because it's, you have to be intentional. And isn't that like the antidote to the assumptions we fall into? The other thing is, you know, when I, years ago, 2019, Eve Rodsky published Fair Play. She wrote Fair Play. Mm-hmm. And some of the principles of Fair Play are like very focused on the mental load, and basically like the basis of the whole system she comes up with for dividing labor is like, let's decide how we want it done and who will do it. And you will learn and practice doing it from the anticipation of the need to fulfilling the need. And that works, I think, in some circumstances to split it up that way. And like, she has a very specific system of doing it. But the basis is there for any successful relationship is just like, how do we communicate clearly and do so with clear expectations, no matter what it looks like, anytime. And I like what you said about like going into something with the full breadth of understanding of here's how I would like to enter this partnership. Here's what I would like our partnership to look like with the information I currently have. And then if it ends, how will that look? Or if it transitions to a different structure, however you want to state that. Mm-hmm. Like, life changes. And also what I appreciate is opening, when you have those conversations, you also open the door to, hey, if we get new info or if something changes, like, we have to be on the same page that it is, we get to renegotiate here.
yeah, co-writing, co-creating the thing together instead of just like falling into a default.
I think that like if things change, peace is also one that in my perception, people do not think about very much and also feels very tied up in disability to me. I feel like it just feels like most people don't calculate like our bodies and minds changing over time and how that affects dynamics in homes. And that has been a part of our experience in our family. Like, obviously, I am physically disabled and brought that into our partnership. And then Micah was diagnosed with cancer when we'd been together for a few years. And his body has changed a lot through that. And I am really, really curious to talk to you about how disability fits into these scripts we have around care work and domestic labor. And I want to preface this by saying that one of the best, coolest parts of being in a relationship that includes disability, like at least in my experience, is that it has this way of disrupting any of the default norms or like assumptions that go into a partnership, particularly with gender norms, I think, and especially around care work and domestic work. Like, we get to start from scratch. We're invited to start from scratch together. Like, what makes the most sense in our little ecosystem as a family? And that is a gift. And also, I mostly just have like this deep angst, internal angst that I want to bring you and hopefully we can like unpack together. Even when we were just talking a minute ago about how like the mom figure in the partnership is typically becomes the default parent. And as a visibly physically disabled mom parent in our partnership, that is not the case for me a lot of times. You know, we talk about like the way that society will just like sort of look towards that mom parent, like as the one to call when the school has a problem or like as the one to that will know what is packed in the bag or whatever. And that is not the default that I experience. And I don't know how much of that is like people putting it on me and how much of it is me just being like super paranoid about it because I'm aware of it. And it's important to me, apparently, to reassert that I am the default parent and how dare you not see me as the default parent, which is like weird. Like, why is this an impulse that I have or why do I feel so protective of it or why does it feel important to me that I also like feel the weight of these oppressive scripts that other moms in partnerships feel? Like, I feel really, it reminds me a little bit about like in my book I wrote about like, okay, I don't actually want to be catcalled on the street, but I'm a little offended that I don't get to also be catcalled on the street. You know, like this weird, gnarly, twisted up, like longing for something that actually doesn't even make sense or that isn't actually desirable or that we're actually trying to undo. So, Laura, if you can help me understand this impulse and like what is actually underneath this and maybe possibly could we untangle this in a way that is helpful in actually rebuilding a script? Or like, if we are actually trying to build something new, can this be some kind of clue or piece in that reworking? I don't know, but I have weird feelings about it.
I mean, maybe this is some, I feel like this is probably related. I often feel resentful that a lot of things come easily to my husband that do not come easily to me. He appears to be able to have measured conversations with our children in ways that I cannot, and can like think through basic tasks that take me a ton of effort and stress me out. The other day, I tried to go out and I needed to book a babysitter and make sure dinner was ready. And I spiraled all day and I was like, I'm going to screw it up. I'm not like, my anxiety has been real high, which is part of the moods. And I did end up like messing up a bunch of stuff because I was all scrambled. And then like the ADHD executive function plays in the, my incapability, like of managing my moods came in, and then I felt super guilty about how I showed up. And I feel really bummed that that's my experience. I feel It's a real impact on the people in my life. And I want to be the kind of put together mom. And like, I want it to look easy and I want it to be easy in ways that I've seen it for other people. And also, I don't want to be like them.
Yeah,
I don't want the shiny house and like, it's not who I am, but also I want it to be possible and I want other people to think I'm that, even though I don't want that. And I think that maybe that plays into like when I thought that I was choosing a certain life, because I wanted to want that thing that I think other people want and I want it to come easy to me, but it doesn't. So it is, it's like really messy. And then I feel angry at myself and I feel angry at him. And then I just shut down.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I don't, I mean, it's just, I guess I share that because it's so messy.
Yeah. Yeah. That really resonates with me. What I jotted down in my notebook is like, I don't want that, but I do want that. And like the tension between, right? Like I don't want that. I want to embody, it's like this. I want to embody the counter to that narrative that also looks really pleasing and easy and lovely and not messy. Like it's like embodying the alternative is rough, even though it's technically what we want. Or like I have this vision or this fantasy, and I did before my son was born more than I do now, of like embodying disability motherhood in this like really scrappy counterculture way, where I was like, I'm going to be this and it's going to be so like electrifying to embody this alternative way. But it's like really bumpy and rough and like often unpleasant and painful. And it's not super fun to embody that, even though I think technically, objectively, and from a distance, I love that we do that. But in it, it just feels rough. It feels really rough. So I like that picture, Laura, of like a return to the core value of why this actually does feel important to disrupt that other like sort of flawless picture. And also acknowledging why it can be uncomfortable to embody it.
Yeah, I remember being a teenager and how it feels to get unwanted attention. Anytime, though, there is a very uncomfortable space to sit getting unwanted attention and then not getting unwanted attention. It again, it's very messy. And to your point, like it's like outside validation, and there's safety in that, in being what everybody else says is good.
Yeah, or like someone seeing. Yeah, I mean, when I hear external validation, it's sort of like someone outside signaling that you are what you think you are, that you are what you want to be, or somebody being able to tell you that. Like if our pediatrician looks to me when she's talking about Otto's care versus Micah, then I can know, oh, she does see me as a valid parent. Mm-hmm. But that's so flimsy. It's just such a flimsy. And like the carrot that you're always chasing of like needing that every turn. I don't know.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
Can we talk a little bit more about like neurodivergence and bipolar 2 and how that layer fits into this too? Because that feels like an important part of it to name, of like, how do you, and you mentioned a little bit of that with like the example that you just gave with the executive functioning and the planning and the messiness of that. But I'm curious about how you, your own experience of these diagnoses and coming to them, like understanding them later in life. Do you see those as disruptors of these default scripts around care work and domestic labor? Or do you see it as like something that makes it harder to break out of those default scripts? Like, how does that layer weave in your experience into all of that's a big question I'm asking you.
Yeah. I do think like what happened to me the other day where I just like totally shut down is a decent example of like, you know, I've been thinking about it for days, how I handled that. And thinking back to other moments where I've like really, I don't always notice, other people notice before I do when I'm like hitting a swing up or down. And it, having a diagnosis, you know, I have medication, which has made my life so much better, but it also gives me the language to tell people in my life, like, hey, I'm not having a good time today. And verbalizing it allows me to relieve some of that pressure. Like, I think a couple of years ago, one of the biggest arguments I had with my husband was around the dishes, because he would say, I'll do the dishes. And he worked long hours and I worked from home. And if he didn't do the dishes in the morning and he forgot, he intended on doing them at night, but now it's there. I see it all day and I can't cook dinner because the pot is in there and I feel this pressure to do it. And I would just, like, every time there were some dishes in the sink, I would get this physical reaction of anxiety and anger and resentment that this feels hard for me and I can do it. Why can't you do it? And now I have had to unpack, like, when I am pushing myself far past my capacity and sort of stewing in it, and like, I'm so afraid, I feel like everything is out of control and I need to clean. And I have to unpack and be like, dude, are you having a problem with like feeling out of control? Are you through an anxiety spiral? Does this really matter? What part of the task matters? And it's given my husband and I clarity around like, I can clearly communicate, like, dude, it feels like crap when you leave this because I feel responsibility. Mm. Here are the, wash the pots and the forks. That's it. And if you don't get to it, I'm not going to be mad that there's dishes in the sink. I'm going to do it and you can help me out later. Like, it just has taken the edge off to have these, this better understanding of like, this isn't about, it's not about the dishes. Mm-hmm. It's also not about like, we haven't communicated about standards. It's more like, it's messy. And some days, so for months, I might be depressed and our house is going to look like shit. And both of us need to like unpack our social pressures around this, figure out how to communicate through it, what we need. And I don't think I had that permission. I hadn't given myself permission to talk about that stuff before. I was just like, Laura, you're a fucking slacker. You can't keep up with me. And I'd like finger point at him. And the whole time we're comparing ourselves to other people instead of paying attention to what we needed and what worked for us.
And doesn't it a little bit feel like if you even have to have the conversation that then, how am I trying to say this? I feel like in my partnership, we're coming to a place where we're having to like rewind a bunch of stuff. And I've been so resistant to having a conversation about it because I'm like, that's so basic. I don't even want to have to talk about the house. Like my pendulum swung all the way in the other direction. And I was like, well, I will never do his laundry. I will never clean his dish. I will never do anything. And also, we're not going to really talk about it because even talking about domesticity is, it's for the plebs. Like, we would not even for me, this is all woven together in like neurodivergence and also gender and also religious trauma. And, you know, there's like so many layers mm-hmm. and to like peel them all apart mm-hmm. and like bring them back together in some way is, I feel like I'm so incoherent today. I was like weeping a second ago. I'm just like, this is
Well, you, this has been like a long ongoing thing that you've been sort of unraveling. I mean, in layers of it, it's like the neurodivergence piece is the like in, it's the own, like the way Laura was talking about, the shame spiral of like, the neurodivergent executive functioning brain thing reminds me of the way that you've talked about that, the scripts that you have, like the way Laura was naming before her diagnosis, just feeling like, oh, you're just a piece of shit. Like, why can't you just do these things? All of that is wrapped up in you and things I've heard you talk about so much lately. And Laura's just sort of like putting her finger on all of the buttons.
Yeah, you just pressed every button.
And it's so... it feels really personal. I think for me, like personally, I think that's what's been so empowering. I'm 36. I've been on the internet since Friendster and DeviantArt. And like, you know, like I've been online public facing for so long and I've always found connection in an online platform. But I'm also like a bit of a loudmouth and person too. I swing both ways. I'll like sit back and not say a word for a while. And then I think that my filter is very thin. So once I start talking, I'm like, oh God, I should have shut up. But it's, I have come to love that about myself, that it's just like, why aren't we talking about this? This is such an intense experience. And we aren't talking about how walking into the kitchen and seeing dishes is like, oh, my self-worth, outside pressure. I'm never going to have it together. I am the kid who couldn't meet their potential and I'm smart and why can't I do it?
And also like to care about that feels like it's like gendered me in a way. For me to be upset about the dishes, but my partner to not be upset about the dishes makes me the nagging.
There's the sitcom wife. Yes.
And also... the way that my brain functions and ADHD and I don't know what I'm in a journey of figuring out what is going on with me. So I'm between diagnoses, but it's not that I need to be in control and have a perfect house. And also when my house is in disarray, my thoughts are in like I can't breathe. Like I get a visceral, like it is somatic for me. Like I feel... the dishes I can and also I have made deep commitments to myself where I am not going to be the default person who takes care of the house, and still I kind of am. And the tension of being like, I don't care about this, I'm not prioritizing it, my work is important, my friendships are important, making art is important, taking my kid on an adventure is important. My house is not that important. But then the like horror and terror that washes over me when someone comes over, and the amount of times I have canceled plans on people, or when my in-laws walk in the door and I want to die. And also a little bit of me is pretty sure that I'm the one that's being judged about it and not my partner. And then that pisses me off because So it's like, I don't want to be the person who keeps a tidy house. Also, my brain to function needs a tidy house. And when people come and see it not tidy, one of the moments of highest shame and anxiety for me. And all of it's so tangled up. And then when you add in like executive dysfunction and you're like, I want this room tidy. I need it tidy. How do I make myself get it tidy? Like that hurdle. And then when there's like three other people living in my house who aren't following the system I created, but also I don't want to spend my time being the person nagging about it, because also it's not that deep. Like this is not the memory I want my child to have of me, of like complaining that the toys aren't put away or everyone's shit isn't up, because it doesn't matter if everyone got in a car accident tomorrow and was like dying. It wouldn't matter, you know? And also, it like really fucking matters. And it's embarrassing. I just feel so much shame and embarrassment and tension and overwhelm. And
it's all in your house. It's all, you literally can't get away from it.
It's all right in the place that I spend all of my time. Yeah.
Yes. It's like, so what is standing out to me as you are naming all of these deeply relatable things is how powerful these scripts are, how deeply personal they are, mm-hmm. and how little skill or comfort we have with actually just like naming them and talking about them openly. Like that combination, that recipe is just like enough to make a person implode, I think.
Well, okay, here's a piece of interesting hope. There is this data. They need to study all of this more. But there is this piece of data that I try to rely on often, which is when the expectations meet the reality, we're happier. So that's when I'm feeling that pure chaos. Like this just happened probably 2 weeks ago. I was like fighting back tears in the kitchen, being like, I did all of this stuff and I'm like, this is not what we worked toward. And just freaking out because I'm the default parent, the one who's home, the one who takes the days off. And I hated that, you know, my husband didn't even realize there was a day off coming up. And I was like, so sarcastic. I was like, so are you going to be home? Like, because we both knew that it was going to be me. And so we had a conversation. What I did was I had to bring it up and I had to not be sarcastic. And I hated that I felt like I had to tone police myself. I wanted to be sarcastic. I was mad. But what he had to do was acknowledge, we just both had to acknowledge it. And I was like, okay, you're in a project right now. You have this job. I have this job. Let's acknowledge that I'm the one who's the default. Let's say it out loud. I'm the one who, if you can't be home on time, you know I'm going to be here. I'm the one who's going to automatically take the day off if we don't talk about it. I am watching the fridge. I am paying attention to the doctor's appointments. And I think people get defensive. And he had the opportunity to go, what, you think I don't do anything? Or like, just be like, go, you think I'm a piece of shit? Both of us were just like, this is it. Let's be real about what's going on. And if we're going to have friends over, I'm going to need your help. And like saying out loud, like, I know it's not a big deal to you, but it really matters to me. So like, we're just going to have to be realistic about that. But knowing that, like, saying it out loud and getting on the same page has scientific back, research backed reality that makes us happier. Cool.
I mean, expectation is such a powerful piece in all. I mean, expectation, to me, expectation almost feels like the synonym to story. It's like the picture we have in our head. It's the thing that we think this should look like. And I guess that feels like that's why we keep coming back to like new scripts. And I love, Laura, what you do, because I feel like you're like actually in the trenches doing that out in the world. It's like, let's call out this script for what it is and let's think of a different way to do it. This is another picture of how we could actually communicate through this, or how this age-old fight could go.
Well, and I'm hearing too, it's like, it's the expectation, but it also feels just like the acknowledgement. Like if you are the default parent for those things, to not like feel like you both are moving around pretending that you're both doing the same, picking up the same labor. I know when Charlie was little, Andrew and I had, there's been moments where we've had some things where I'm like, dude, I am doing the default. And as Charlie's gotten bigger, it definitely feels like way, way more equitable. And sometimes I feel like Andrew is the default now. But if it can just be named and acknowledged, and that there is like a sense of gratitude, which presumes that it's not presumed that would be you, you know, like to be able to say, wow, thanks for always getting the kids on the day off and knowing that, like, I see you knowing when the kids are off and I see you doing it, I see that that is like, instead of it just being like, that's the thing you do, that feels so huge and important for you both to just be like acknowledging what the other one is doing.
Well, Laura, would you tell us a little bit? You have a book coming out that we are super excited about. Would you tell us any details that you can about what we can expect from it?
Yes. I'm really excited about this book. It's written in three parts. The first part is a bit of context about the scripts that we have followed, that we have been taught, the role of care in our lives, how care has been gendered, racialized. It gives some language on emotional labor, mental labor, anger, the whole idea of that sitcom syndrome where we see ourselves in the nag and then we just laugh. And why? And then the second part, it digs into things like the nag paradox, where we keep trying well-intentioned to give each other, you know, give lists, let's delegate, let's tackle this as a team, but it's not actually a team. And I talk a little bit about weaponized incompetence. And the last part is a little bit of, it's imagining a future. So beyond the nuclear family, beyond solving things on your own, and throughout, so it's a little bit about community, the work I've done in my neighborhood. I share some of that and examples of, you know, what collective care or mutual aid in action looks like. And so my hope is that it will cause us, or it will help facilitate some reflection and some, get some additional context, spark some hope. And throughout, I have sprinkled in actionable steps. So it's not like some theory specifically. It's, we have things we can do every day. Here's what we can do.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a book for right now. Like that, this is a book we need right now.
Yeah. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. Well, we will share more about it in the show notes. We'll all be looking for pre-order links when they're available.
Yay. I'm excited about it. And I want to hear from everyone. You can find me on That Darn Chat and my DMs are open.
That's very generous of you. You must have a very busy DM life.
Periodically, I will say something that people don't like or have strong feelings about. And I will say, hey, don't DM me. And people respect it.
Nice.
You know what? You're mad at me? Cool. Talk to someone about why you're mad at me. That's helpful. I will talk to other people about why I'm mad at myself. Offline.
Nice. Thank you for being here.
Woo-hoo, we love you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
Bye.
Woo-hoo. This podcast is edited and perfected by the most beautiful wizard and my favorite dude, Micah Jones.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.